His second fear materialized. She smiled and jumped down the three leaning steps to join him. Her eyes were full of compassion, and Charlie remembered that he was the bereaved. "If you want to," she said, "but not too far. Mama said we got to leave early, and it's getting dark." The four of them moved away. Some of the other boys had come to the porch and were about to begin that partly hostile, partly indifferent, partly desperate mating dance. Suki, Jake, Darlene, and Charlie walked through several backyards until they came to an open field. They ran across it and came to a dry riverbed lined with green. The object of the walk was a wild vineyard where the muscadine grew. Too new, too tight to have much sugar, they were eaten anyway. None of them wanted, not then, the grape's easy relinquishing of all its dark juice. The restraint, the holding off, the promise of sweetness that had yet to unfold excited them more than full ripeness would have done. At last, their teeth were on edge, and the boys diverted themselves by pelting the girls with the grapes. Their slim, black boy wrists made G clefts in the air as they executed the tosses. The chase took Charlie and Darlene away from the lip of the gully, and when they paused for breath, Jake and Suki were nowhere in sight. Darlene's white cotton dress was stained with juice. Her big blue hair bow had come undone, and the sundown breeze was picking it up and fluttering it about her head. They were out of breath and sank down in the green and purple grass on the edge of the pine woods. Charlie lay on his back, panting, his mouth full of the taste of muscadine, listening to the pine needles rustling loudly in their anticipation of rain. The smell of promised rain, pine, and muscadine made him giddy. The sun had gone and pulled away its shreds of light. Turning his head to see where the moon was, Charlie caught the sight of Darlene in moonlight behind him. She was huddled into a D, arms encircling drawn-up knees on which she rested her head. Charlie could see her bloomers and the muscles of her young thighs. "We bet get on back," he said. "Yeah." She stretched her legs flat on the ground and began to retie her hair ribbon. "Mama gonna whoop me." "No, she ain't." "Uh-huh. She told me she would if I get dirty." "You ain't dirty." "I am too. Look at that." She dropped her hands from the ribbon and smoothed out a place on her dress where the grape stains were heaviest. Charlie felt sorry for her. It was just as much his fault. Suddenly he realized that Aunt Jimmy was dead, for he missed the fear of being whipped. There was nobody to do it, except Uncle O.V., and he was the bereaved, too. "Let me," he said. He rose to his knees facing her and tried to tie her ribbon. Darlene put her hands under his open shirt and rubbed the damp, tight skin. When he looked at her in surprise, she stopped and laughed. He smiled and continued knotting the bow. She put her hands back under his shirt. "Hold still," he said. "How I gonna get this?" She tickled his ribs with her fingertips. He giggled and grabbed his rib cage. They were on top of each other in a moment. She corkscrewing her hands into his clothes, he returning the play, digging into the neck of her dress and then under her dress. When he got his hand in her bloomers, she suddenly stopped laughing and looked serious. Charlie, frightened, was about to take his hand away, but she held his wrist so he couldn't move it. He examined her then with his fingers, and she kissed his face and mouth. Charlie found her muscadine-lipped mouth distracting. Darlene released his head, shifted her body, and pulled down her pants. After some trouble with the buttons, Charlie dropped his pants down to his knees. Their bodies began to make sense to him, and it was not as difficult as he had thought it would be. She moaned a little, but the excitement collecting inside him made him close his eyes and regard her moans as no more than pine sighs over his head. Just as he felt an explosion threaten, Darlene froze and cried out. He thought he had hurt her, but when he looked at her face, she was staring wildly at something over his shoulder. He jerked around. There stood two white men, one with a spirit lamp, the other with a flashlight. There was no mistake about their being white. He could smell it. Charlie jumped, trying to kneel, stand, and get his pants up, all in one motion. The men had long guns. Hee-hee! Hee-hee! The snicker was a long, asthmatic cough. The other raced the flashlight all over Charlie and Darlene. Get on with it, nigger, said the flashlight one. Sir, said Charlie, trying to find a buttonhole. I said get on with it, and make it good, nigger, make it good. There was no place for Charlie's eyes to go. They slid about furtively, searching for shelter, while his body remained paralyzed. The flashlight man lifted his gun down from his shoulder, and Charlie heard the clop of metal. He dropped back to his knees. Darlene had her head averted, her eyes staring out of the lamplight into the surrounding darkness and looking almost unconcerned, as though they had no part in the drama taking place around them. With a violence born of total helplessness, he pulled her dress up, lowered his trousers and underwear. Hee-hee! Darlene put her hands over her face as Charlie began to simulate what had gone on before. He could do no more than make believe. The flashlight made a moon on his behind. Hee-hee! Come on, coon, faster. You ain't doing nothing for her. Hee-hee-hee! Charlie, moving faster, looked at Darlene. He hated her. He almost wished he could do it, hard, long, and painfully. He hated her so much. The flashlight wormed its way into his guts and turned the sweet taste of muscadine into rotten, fetid bile. He stared at Darlene's hands, covering her face in the moonlight. They looked like baby claws. Hee, 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 hee. Some dogs howled. That's them. That's them. I know that's old honey. Yep, said the spirit lamp. Come on. The flashlight turned away, and one of them whistled to honey. Wait, said the spirit lamp. The coon ain't come yet. Well, he have to come on his own time. Good luck, coon baby. They crushed the pine needles underfoot. Charlie could hear them whistling for a long time, and then the dog's answer, no longer a howl, but warm, excited yelps of recognition. Charlie raised himself and in silence buttoned his trousers. Darlene did not move. Charlie wanted to strangle her, but instead he touched her leg with his foot. We gotta get, girl. Come on. She reached for her underwear with her eyes closed and could not find them. The two of them padded about in the moonlight for the panties. When she found them, she put them on with the movements of an old woman. They walked away from the pine woods toward the road, he in front, she plopping along behind. It started to rain. That's good, Charlie thought. It will explain away our clothes. When they got back to the house, some 10 or 12 guests were still there. Jake was gone. Suki, too. Some people had gone back for more helpings of food. Potato pie, ribs, All were engrossed in early night reminiscences about dreams, figures, premonitions. Their stuffed comfort was narcotic and had produced recollections and fabrications of hallucinations. Charlie and Darlene's entrance produced only a mild stir. "Y'all soaked, ain't you?" Darlene's mother was only vaguely fussy. She had eaten and drunk too much. Her shoes were under her chair, and the side snaps of her dress were open. "Girl, come on in here. Thought I told you." Some of the guests thought they would wait for the rain to slacken. Others, who had come in wagons, thought they'd best leave now. Charlie went into the little storeroom, which had been made into a bedroom for him. Three infants were sleeping on his cot. He took off his rain and pine-soaked clothes and put on his coveralls. He didn't know where to go. Aunt Jimmy's room was out of the question, and Uncle Ovi and his wife would be using it later anyway. He took a quilt from a trunk, spread it on the floor, and lay down. Somebody was brewing coffee, and he had a sharp craving for it just before falling asleep. The next day was cleaning out day, settling accounts, distributing Aunt Jimmy's goods. Mouths were set in downward crescents, eyes veiled, feet tentative. Charlie floated about aimlessly, doing chores as he was told. All the glamour and warmth the adults had given him on the previous day were replaced by a sharpness that agreed with his mood. He could think only of the flashlight, the muscadines, and Darlene's hands. And when he was not thinking of them, the vacancy in his head was like the space left by a newly pulled tooth, still conscious of the rottenness that had once filled it. Afraid of running into Darlene, he would not go far from the house, but neither could he endure the atmosphere of his dead aunt's house, the picking through her things, the comments on the condition of her goods. Sullen, irritable, he cultivated his hatred of Darlene. Never did he once consider directing his hatred toward the hunters. Such an emotion would have destroyed him. They were big, white, armed men. He was small, black, helpless. His subconscious knew what his conscious mind did not, that hating them would have consumed him, burned him up like a piece of soft coal, leaving only flakes of ash and a question mark of smoke. He was, in time, to discover that hatred of white men, but not now. Not in impotence, but later, when the hatred could find sweet expression. For now, he hated the one who had created the situation, the one who bore witness to his failure, his impotence, the one whom he had not been able to protect, to spare, to cover from the round moon glow of the flashlight. The hee-hee-hees. He recalled Darlene's dripping hair ribbon, flapping against her face as they walked back in silence in the rain. The loathing that galloped through him made him tremble. There was no one to talk to. Old Blue was too drunk too often these days to make sense. Besides, Charlie doubted if he could reveal his shame to Blue. He would have to lie a little to tell Blue the woman killer. It seemed to him that lonely was much better than alone. The day Charlie's uncle was ready to leave, when everything was packed, when the quarrels about who gets what had seethed down to a sticking gravy on everybody's tongue, Charlie sat on the back porch waiting. It had occurred to him that Darlene might be pregnant. It was a wildly irrational, completely uninformed idea, but the fear it produced was complete enough. He had to get away. Never mind the fact that he was leaving that very day. A town or two away, was not far enough, especially since he did not like or trust his uncle, and Darlene's mother could surely find him, and Uncle O.V. would turn him over to her. Charlie knew it was wrong to run out on a pregnant girl, and recalled with sympathy that his father had done just that. Now he understood. He knew then what he must do. Find his father. His father would understand. Aunt Jimmy said he had gone to Macon. With no more thought than a chick leaving its shell, he stepped off the porch. He had gotten a little way when he remembered the treasure. Aunt Jimmy had left something, and he had forgotten all about it. In a stove flue no longer used, she had hidden a little meal bag, which she called her treasure. He slipped into the house and found the room empty. Digging into the flue, he encountered webs and soot, and then the soft bag. He sorted the money. 14 $1 bills, 2 $2 bills, and lots of silver change. $23 in all. Surely that would be enough to get to Macon. What a good, strong-sounding word, Macon. Running away from home for a Georgia black boy was not a great problem. You just sneaked away and started walking. When night came, you slept in a barn, if there were no dogs, a cane field, or an empty sawmill. You ate from the ground and bought root beer and licorice in little country stores. There was always an easy tale of woe to tell inquiring black adults, and whites didn't care, unless they were looking for sport. When he was several days away, he could go to the back door of nice houses and tell the black cook or white mistress that he wanted a job weeding, plowing, picking, cleaning, and that he lived nearby. A week or more there, and he could take off. He lived this way through the turn of summer, and only the following October did he reach a town big enough to have a regular bus station. Dry-mouthed with excitement and apprehension, he went to the colored side of the counter to buy his ticket. How much to Macon, sir? $11. $5.50 for children under 12. Charlie had $12.04. How old you be? Just on 12, sir. But my mama only give me $10. You just about the biggest 12 I ever seed. Please, sir. I gotta get to Macon. My mama's sick. Thought you said your mama give you $10. That's my play mama. My real mama is in Macon, sir. I reckon I knows a lying nigger when I sees one. But just in case you ain't. Just in case one of them mammies is really dying and wants to see her little old smoke before she meets her maker, I gon' do it. Charlie heard nothing. The insults were part of the nuisances of life, like lice. He was happier than he had ever remembered being, except that time with Blue and the watermelon. The bus wasn't leaving for 4 hours, and the minutes of those hours struggled like gnats on flypaper, dying slow, exhausted with the fight to stay alive. Charlie was afraid to stir, even to relieve himself. The bus might leave while he was gone. Finally, rigid with constipation, he boarded the bus to Macon. He found a window seat in the back all to himself, and all of Georgia slid before his eyes until the sun shrugged out of sight. Even in the dark, he hungered to see, and only after the fiercest fight to keep his eyes open did he fall asleep. When he awoke, it was very well into day, and a fat black lady was nudging him with a biscuit gashed with cold bacon. With the taste of bacon still in his teeth, they sidled into Macon. At the end of the alley, he could see men clustered like grapes, One large whooping voice spiraled over the heads of the bended forms, the kneeling forms, the leaning forms, all intent on one ground spot. As he came closer, he inhaled a rife and stimulating man smell. The men were gathered, just as the man in the pool hall had said, for and about dice and money. Each figure was decorated some way with the slight pieces of green. Some of them had separated their money, folded the bills around their fingers, clenched the fingers into fists, so the neat ends of the money stuck out in a blend of daintiness and violence. Others had stacked their bills, creased them down the middle, and held the wad as though they were about to deal cards. Still others had left their money in loosely crumpled balls. One man had money sticking out from under his cap. Another stroked his bills with a thumb and forefinger. There was more money in those black hands than Charlie had ever seen before. He shared their excitement, and the dry-mouthed apprehension on meeting his father gave way to the saliva flow of excitement. He glanced at the faces, looking for the one who might be his father. How would he know him? Would he look like a larger version of himself? At that moment, Charlie could not remember what his own self looked like. He only knew he was 14 years old, black, and already 6 feet tall. He searched the faces and saw only eyes, pleading eyes, cold eyes, eyes gone flat with malice, others laced with fear, all focused on the movement of a pair of dice that one man was throwing, snatching up and throwing again, chanting a kind of litany to which the others responded, rubbing the dice as though they were two hot coals. He whispered to them. Then with a whoop, the cubes flew from his hand to a chorus of amazements and disappointments. Then the thrower scooped up money and someone shouted, "Take it and crawl, you water dog, you the best I know." There was some laughter and a noticeable release of tension during which some men exchanged money. Charlie tapped an old, white-haired man on the back. "Can you tell me, is Samson Fuller around here somewhere?" "Fuller?" The name was familiar to the man's tongue. "I don't know. He here somewhere. There he is, in the brown jacket." The man pointed. A man in a light brown jacket stood at the far end of the group. He was gesturing in a quarrelsome, agitated manner with another man. Both of them had folded their faces in anger. Charlie edged around to where they stood, hardly believing he was at the end of his journey. There was his father, a man like any other man, but there indeed were his eyes, his mouth, his whole head. His shoulders lurked beneath that jacket, his voice, his hands, all real. They existed, really existed, somewhere, right here. Charlie had always thought of his father as a giant of a man, so when he was very close, it was with a shock that he discovered that he was taller than his father. In fact, he was staring at a balding spot on his father's head, which he suddenly wanted to stroke. While thus fascinated by the pitiable clean space hedged around by neglected tufts of wool, the man turned a hard, belligerent face to him. "What you want, boy?" "Is you Samson Fuller? Who sent you?" "Huh? You Melba's boy?" "No, sir, I'm..." Charlie blinked. He could not remember his mother's name. Had he ever known it? What could he say? Whose boy was he? He couldn't say, "I'm your boy." That sounded disrespectful. The man was impatient. "Something wrong with your head? Who told you to come after me?" Nobody. Charlie's hands were sweating. The man's eyes frightened him. I just thought, I mean, I was just wandering around and, my name is Charlie. But Fuller had turned back to the game that was about to begin anew. He bent down to toss a bill on the ground and waited for a throw. When it was gone, he stood up and in a vexed and whiny voice shouted at Charlie, "Tell that bitch she'd get her money. Now get the fuck out of my face." Charlie was a long time picking his foot up from the ground. He was trying to back up and walk away. Only with extreme effort could he get the first muscle to cooperate. When it did, he walked back up the alley, out of its shade, toward the blazing light of the street. As he emerged into the sun, he felt something in his legs give way. An orange crate with a picture of clasping hands pasted on its side was upended on the sidewalk. Charlie sat down on it. The sunshine dropped like honey on his head. A horse-drawn fruit wagon went by, its driver singing, "Fresh from the vine, sweet as sugar, red as wine." Noises seemed to increase in volume. The click-clock of the women's heels, the laughter of idling men in doorways. There was a streetcar somewhere. Charlie sat. He knew if he was very still, he would be all right. But then the trace of pain edged his eyes, and he had to use everything to send it away. If he was very still, he thought, and kept his eyes on one thing, the tears would not come. So he sat in the dripping honey sun, pulling every nerve and muscle into service to stop the fall of water from his eyes. While straining in this way, focusing every erg of energy on his eyes, his bowels suddenly opened up, and before he could realize what he knew, liquid stools were running down his legs. At the mouth of the alley where his father was, on an orange crate in the sun, on a street full of grown men and women, he had soiled himself like a baby. In panic, he wondered, should he wait there, not moving until nighttime? No, his father would surely emerge and see him and laugh. Oh, Lord, he would laugh. Everybody would laugh. There was only one thing to do. Charlie ran down the street, aware only of silence. People's mouths moved, their feet moved, a car jugged by, but with no sound. A door slammed in perfect soundlessness. His own feet made no sound. The air seemed to strangle him, hold him back. He was pushing through a world of invisible pine sap that threatened to smother him. Still he ran, seeing only silent, moving things, until he came to the end of buildings, the beginning of open space, and saw the Okmulgee River winding ahead. He scooted down a gravelly slope to a pier, jutting out over the shallow water. Finding the deepest shadow under the pier, he crouched in it, behind one of the posts. He remained knotted there, in fetal position, paralyzed, his fists covering his eyes for a long time. No sound, no sight, only darkness and heat and the press of his knuckles on his eyelids. He even forgot his messed up trousers. Evening came, the dark, the warmth, the quiet enclosed Charlie like the skin and flesh of an elderberry protecting its own seed. Charlie stirred. The ache in his head was all he felt. Soon, like bright bits of glass, the events of that afternoon cut into him. At first, he saw only money in black fingers. Then he thought he was sitting on an uncomfortable chair. But when he looked, it turned out to be the head of a man, a head with a bald spot the size of an orange. When finally these bits merged into full memory, Charlie began to smell himself. He stood up and found himself weak, trembling, and dizzy. He leaned for a moment on the pier post, then took off his pants, underwear, socks, and shoes. He rubbed handfuls of dirt on his shoes. Then he crawled to the river edge. He had to find the water's beginning with his hands, for he could not see it clearly. Slowly he swirled his clothes in the water and rubbed them until he thought they were clean. Back near his post, he took off his shirt and wrapped it around his waist, then spread his trousers and underwear on the ground. He squatted down and picked at the rotted wood of the pier. Suddenly he thought of his Aunt Jemmy, her asphetida bag, her four gold teeth, and the purple rag she wore around her head. With a longing that almost split him open, he thought of her handing him a bit of smoked hock out of her dish. He remembered just how she held it, clumsy-like, in three fingers, but with so much affection. No words, just picking up a bit of meat and holding it out to him. And then the tears rushed down his cheeks to make a bouquet under his chin. Three women are leaning out of two windows. They see the long, clean neck of a new young boy and call to him. He goes to where they are. Inside it is dark and warm. They give him lemonade in a mason jar. As he drinks, their eyes float up to him through the bottom of the jar. Through the slick, sweet water, they give him back his manhood, which he takes aimlessly. The pieces of Charlie's life could become coherent only in the head of a musician. Only those who talk their talk through the gold of curved metal or in the touch of black and white rectangles and taut skins and strings echoing from wooden corridors could give true form to his life. Only they would know how to connect the heart of a red watermelon to the asphetida bag, to the muscadine, to the flashlight on his behind, to the fists of money, to the lemonade in a mason jar, to a man called Blue, and come up with what all of that meant. In joy, in pain, in anger, in love, and give it its final and pervading ache of freedom. Only a musician with sense, know, without even knowing that he knew, that Charlie was free, dangerously free. Free to feel whatever he felt. Fear, guilt, shame, love, grief, pity. Free to be tender or violent, to whistle or weep. Free to sleep in doorways or between the white sheets of a singing woman. Free to take a job, free to leave it. He could go to jail and not feel imprisoned, for he had already seen the furtiveness in the eyes of his jailer. Free to say, "No, sir," and smile, for he had already killed three white men. Free to take a woman's insults, for his body had already conquered hers. Free even to knock her in the head, for he had already cradled that head in his arms. Free to be gentle when she was sick or mop her floor, for she knew what and where his maleness was. He was free to drink himself into a silly helplessness, for he had already been a Gandhi dancer, done 30 days on a chain gang, and picked a woman's bullet out of the calf of his leg. He was free to live his fantasies, and free even to die, the how and the when of which held no interest for him. In those days, Charlie was truly free. Abandoned in a junk heap by his mother, rejected for a crap game by his father, there was nothing more to lose. He was alone with his own perceptions and appetites, and they alone interested him. It was in this godlike state that he met Pauline Williams. And it was Pauline, or rather marrying her, that did for him what the flashlight did not do. The constantness, varietylessness, the sheer weight of sameness drove him to despair and froze his imagination. To be required to sleep with the same woman forever was a curious and unnatural idea to him. To be expected to dredge up enthusiasms for old acts and routine ploys, he wondered at the arrogance of the female. When he had met Pauline in Kentucky, she was hanging over a fence, scratching herself with a broken foot. The neatness, the charm, the joy he awakened in her made him want to nest with her. He had yet to discover what destroyed that desire, but he did not dwell on it. He thought rather of whatever had happened to the curiosity he used to feel. Nothing, nothing interested him now. Not himself, not other people. Only in drink was there some break, some floodlight. And when that closed, there was oblivion. But the aspect of married life that dumbfounded him and rendered him totally dysfunctional was the appearance of children. Having no idea of how to raise children, and having never watched any parent raise himself, he could not even comprehend what such a relationship should be. Had he been interested in the accumulation of things, he could have thought of them as his material heirs. Had he needed to prove himself to some nameless others, he could have wanted them to excel in his own image and for his own sake. Had he not been alone in the world since he was 13, knowing only a dying old woman who felt responsible for him, but whose age, sex, and interests were so remote from his own, he might have felt a stable connection between himself and the children. As it was, he reacted to them, and his reactions were based on what he felt at the moment. So, it was on a Saturday afternoon, in the thin light of spring, he staggered home, reeling drunk, and saw his daughter in the kitchen. She was washing dishes, her small back hunched over the sink. Charlie saw her dimly and could not tell what he saw or what he felt. Then he became aware that he was uncomfortable. Next, he felt the discomfort dissolve into pleasure. The sequence of his emotions was revulsion, guilt, pity, then love. His revulsion was a reaction to her young, helpless, hopeless presence. Her back was hunched that way, her head to one side, as though crouching from a permanent and unrelieved blow. Why did she have to look so whipped? She was a child, unburdened. Why wasn't she happy? The clear statement of her misery was an accusation. He wanted to break her neck, but tenderly. Guilt and impotence rose in a bilious duet. What could he do for her, ever? What give her, what say to her? What could a burned-out black man say to the hunched back of his 11-year-old daughter? If he looked into her face, he would see those haunted, loving eyes. The hauntedness would irritate him. The love would move him to fury. How dare she love him? Hadn't she any sense at all? What was he supposed to do about that? Return it? How? What could his calloused hands produce to make her smile? What of his knowledge of the world and of life could be useful to her? What could his heavy arms and befuddled brain accomplish that would earn him his own respect, that would in turn allow him to accept her love. His hatred of her slimed in his stomach and threatened to become vomit. But just before the puke moved from anticipation to sensation, she shifted her weight and stood on one foot, scratching the back of her calf with her toe. It was a quiet and pitiful gesture. Her hands were going around and around a frying pan, scraping flecks of black into cold, greasy dishwater. The timid, tucked-in look of the scratching toe, that was what Pauline was doing the first time he saw her in Kentucky, leaning over a fence, staring at nothing in particular, the creamy toe of her bare foot scratching a velvet leg. It was such a small and simple gesture, but it filled him then with a wondering softness, not the usual lust to part tight legs with his own, but a tenderness, a protectiveness, a desire to cover her foot with his hand and gently nibble away the itch from the calf with his teeth. He did it then and started Pauline into laughter. He did it now. The tenderness welled up in him, and he sank to his knees, his eyes on the foot of his daughter, crawling on all fours toward her. He raised his hand and caught the foot in an upward stroke. Piccola lost her balance and was about to careen to the floor. Charlie raised his other hand to her hips to save her from falling. He put his head down and nibbled at the back of her leg. His mouth trembled at the firm sweetness of the flesh. He closed his eyes, letting his fingers dig into her waist. The rigidness of her shocked body, the silence of her stunned throat, was better than Pauline's easy laughter had been. The confused mixture of his memories of Pauline and the doing of a wild and forbidden thing excited him, and a bolt of desire ran down his genitals, giving it length and softening the lips of his anus. Surrounding all of this lust was a border of politeness. He wanted to fuck her, tenderly, but the tenderness would not hold. The tightness of her vagina was more than he could bear. His soul seemed to slip down to his guts and fly out into her, and the gigantic thrust he made into her then provoked the only sound she made, a hollow suck of air in the back of her throat, like the rapid loss of air from a circus balloon. Following the disintegration, the falling away of sexual desire, he was conscious of her wet, soapy hands on his wrists, the fingers clenching, but whether her grip was from a hopeless but stubborn struggle to be free, or from some other emotion, he could not tell. Removing himself from her was so painful to him, he cut it short and snatched his genitals out of the dry harbor of her vagina. She appeared to have fainted. Charlie stood up and could see only her grayish panties, so sad and limp around her ankles. Again, the hatred mixed with tenderness. The hatred would not let him pick her up. The tenderness forced him to cover her. So when the child regained consciousness, she was lying on the kitchen floor under a heavy quilt, trying to connect the pain between her legs with the face of her mother looming over her. See the dog, bow wow, goes the dog. Do you want to play? Do you want to play with Jane? See the dog run. Once there was an old man who loved things, for the slightest contact with people produced in him a faint but persistent nausea. He could not remember when this distaste began, nor could he remember ever being free of it. As a young boy, he had been greatly disturbed by this revulsion, which others did not seem to share. But having got a fine education, he learned, among other things, the word misanthrope. Knowing his label provided him with both comfort and courage. He believed that to name an evil was to neutralize, if not annihilate it. Then, too, he had read several books and made the acquaintance of several great misanthropes of the ages, whose spiritual company soothed him and provided him with yardsticks for measuring his whims, his yearnings, and his antipathies. Moreover, he found misanthropy an excellent means of developing character. When he subdued his revulsion and occasionally touched, helped, counseled, or befriended somebody, he was able to think of his behavior as generous and his intentions as noble. When he was enraged by some human effort or flaw, he was able to regard himself as discriminating, fastidious, and full of nice scruples. As in the case of many misanthropes, his disdain for people led him into a profession designed to serve them. He was engaged in a line of work that was dependent solely on his ability to win the trust of others, and one in which the most intimate relationships were necessary. Having dallied with the priesthood in the Anglican Church, he abandoned it to become a caseworker. Time and misfortune, however, conspired against him, and he settled finally on a profession that brought him both freedom and satisfaction. He became a reader, advisor, and interpreter of dreams. It was a profession that suited him well. His hours were his own. The competition was slight. The clientele was already persuaded and therefore manageable. And he had numerous opportunities to witness human stupidity without sharing it or being compromised by it, and to nurture his fastidiousness by viewing physical decay. Although his income was small, he had no taste for luxury. His experience in the monastery had solidified his natural asceticism, while it developed his preference for solitude. Celibacy was a haven, silence a shield. All his life, he had a fondness for things, not the acquisition of wealth or beautiful objects, but a genuine love of worn objects, a coffee pot that had been his mother's, a welcome mat from the door of a rooming house he once lived in, a quilt from a Salvation Army store counter. It was as though his disdain of human contact had converted itself into a craving for things humans had touched, the residue of the human spirit smeared on inanimate objects was all he could withstand of humanity. To contemplate, for example, evidence of human footsteps on the mat, absorb the smell of the quilt, and wallow in the sweet certainty that many bodies had sweated, slept, dreamed, made love, been ill, and even died under it. Wherever he went, he took along his things and was always searching for others. This thirst for worn things led to casual but habitual examinations of trash barrels in alleys and waste baskets in public places. All in all, his personality was an arabesque, intricate, symmetrical, balanced, and tightly constructed. Except for one flaw, the careful design was marred occasionally by rare but keen sexual cravings. He could have been an active homosexual, but lacked the courage. bestiality did not occur to him, and sodomy was quite out of the question, for he did not experience sustained erections and could not endure the thought of somebody else's. And besides, the one thing that disgusted him more than entering and caressing a woman was caressing and being caressed by a man. In any case, his cravings, although intense, never relished physical contact. He abhorred flesh on flesh. Body odor, breath odor overwhelmed him. The sight of dried matter in the corner of the eye, decayed or missing teeth, earwax, blackheads, moles, blisters, skin crusts, all the natural excretions and protections the body was capable of, disquieted him. His attentions, therefore, gradually settled on those humans whose bodies were least offensive, children. And since he was too diffident to confront homosexuality, and since little boys were insulting, scary, and stubborn, he further limited his interests to little girls. They were usually manageable and frequently seductive. His sexuality was anything but lewd. His patronage of little girls smacked of innocence and was associated in his mind with cleanliness. He was what one might call a very clean old man. A cinnamon-eyed West Indian with lightly browned skin. Although his given name was printed on the sign in his kitchen window and on the business cards he circulated, he was called by the townspeople Soaphead Church. No one knew where the church part came from. Perhaps somebody's recollection of his days as a guest preacher, those reverends who had been called, but who had no flock or coop and were constantly visiting other churches, sitting on the altar with the host preacher. But everybody knew what Soaphead meant. The tight, curly hair that took on and held a sheen and wave when pomaded with soap lather, a sort of primitive process. He had been reared in a family proud of its academic accomplishments and its mixed blood. In fact, they believed the former was based on the latter. A Sir Whitcomb, some decaying British nobleman, who chose to disintegrate under a sun more easeful than England's, had introduced the white strain into the family in the early 1800s. Being a gentleman by order of the king, he had done the civilized thing for his mulatto bastard, provided it with £300 sterling, to the great satisfaction of the bastard's mother, who felt that fortune had smiled on her. The bastard, too, was grateful and regarded as his life's goal the hoarding of this white strain. He bestowed his favors on a 15-year-old girl of similar parentage. She, like a good Victorian parody, learned from her husband all that was worth learning, to separate herself in body, mind, and spirit from all that suggested Africa, to cultivate the habits, tastes, preferences that her absent father-in-law and foolish mother-in-law would have approved. They transferred this Anglophilia to their 6 children and 16 grandchildren. Except for an occasional and unaccountable insurgent who chose a restive black, they married up, lightening the family complexion and thinning out the family features. With the confidence born of a conviction of superiority, they performed well at schools. They were industrious, orderly, and energetic, hoping to prove beyond a doubt de Gobineau's hypothesis that all civilizations derive from the white race, that none can exist without its help, and that a society is great and brilliant only so far as it preserves the blood of the noble group that created it. Thus, they were seldom overlooked by schoolmasters who recommended promising students for study abroad. The men studied medicine, law, theology, and emerged repeatedly in the powerless government offices available to the native population. That they were corrupt in public and private practice, both lecherous and lascivious, was considered their noble right and thoroughly enjoyed by most of the less gifted population. As the years passed, due to the carelessness of some of the Whitcomb brothers, it became difficult to maintain their whiteness, and some distant and not so distant relatives married each other. No obviously bad effects were noticed from these ill-advised unions, but one or two old maids or gardener boys marked a weakening of faculties and a disposition toward eccentricity in some of the children. Some flaw outside the usual alcoholism and lechery. They blamed the flaw on intermarriage with the family, however, not on the original genes of the decaying lord. In any case, there were flukes, no more than in any other family, to be sure, but more dangerous because more powerful. One of them was a religious fanatic who founded his own secret sect and fathered four sons, one of whom became a schoolmaster, known for the precision of his justice and the control in his violence. This schoolmaster married a sweet, indolent, half-Chinese girl for whom the fatigue of bearing a son was too much. She died soon after childbirth. Her son, named Elihu Micah Whitcomb, provided the schoolmaster with ample opportunity to work out his theories of education, discipline, and the good life. Little Elihu learned everything he needed to know well, particularly the fine art of self-deception. He read greedily, but understood selectively, choosing the bits and pieces of other men's ideas that supported whatever predilection he had at the moment. Thus he chose to remember Hamlet's abuse of Ophelia, but not Christ's love of Mary Magdalene. Hamlet's frivolous politics, but not Christ's serious anarchy. He noticed Gibbon's acidity, but not his tolerance. Othello's love for the fair Desdemona, but not Iago's perverted love of Othello. The works he admired most were Dante's. Those he despised most were Dostoevsky's. For all his exposure to the best minds of the Western world, he allowed only the narrowest interpretation to touch him. He responded to his father's controlled violence by developing hard habits and a soft imagination, a hatred of and fascination with any hint of disorder or decay. At 17, however, he met his Beatrice, who was 3 years his senior, a lovely, laughing, big-legged girl who worked as a clerk in a Chinese department store. Velma. So strong was her affection and zest for life, she did not eliminate the frail, sickly Elihu from it. She found his fastidiousness and complete lack of humor touching, and longed to introduce him to the idea of delight. He resisted the introduction, but she married him anyway, only to discover that he was suffering from and enjoying an invincible melancholy. When she learned, 2 months into the marriage, how important his melancholy was to him, that he was very interested in altering her joy to a more academic gloom, that he equated lovemaking with communion and the Holy Grail, she simply left. She had not lived by the sea all those years, listened to the wharfman's songs all that time, to spend her life in the soundless cave of Elihu's mind. He never got over her desertion. She was to have been the answer to his unstated, unacknowledged question. Where was the life to counter the encroaching non-life? Velma was to rescue him from the non-life he had learned on the flat side of his father's belt. But he resisted her with such skill that she was finally driven out to escape the inevitable boredom produced by such a dainty life. Young Elihu was saved from visible shattering by the steady hand of his father, who reminded him of the family's reputation and Velma's questionable one. He then pursued his studies with more vigor than before and decided at last to enter the ministry. When he was advised that he had no avocation, he left the island, came to America to study the then budding field of psychiatry. But the subject required too much truth, too many confrontations, and offered too little support to a failing ego. He drifted into sociology, then physical therapy. This diverse education continued for 6 years when his father refused to support him any longer until he found himself. Elihu, not knowing where to look, was thrown back on his own devices and found himself quite unable to earn money. He began to sink into a rapidly fraying gentility, punctuated with a few of the white-collar occupations available to black people, regardless of their noble bloodlines in America. Desk clerk at a colored hotel in Chicago, insurance agent, traveling salesman for a cosmetics firm catering to blacks. He finally settled in Lorain, Ohio, in 1931, palming himself off as a minister and inspiring awe with the way he spoke English. The women of the town early discovered his celibacy, and not being able to comprehend his rejection of them, decided that he was supernatural rather than unnatural. Once he understood their decision, he quickly followed through, accepting the name Soaphead Church and the role they had given him. He rented a kind of backroom apartment from a deeply religious old lady named Bertha Reese. She was clean, quiet, and very close to total deafness. The lodgings were ideal in every way but one. Bertha Reese had an old dog, Bob, who, although as deaf and quiet as she, was not as clean. He slept most of his days away on the back porch, which was Elihu's entrance. The dog was too old to be of any use, and Bertha Reese had not the strength or presence of mind to care for him properly. She fed him and watered him, left him alone. The dog was mangy. His exhausted eyes ran with a sea-green matter around which gnats and flies clustered. Soaphead was revolted by Bob and wished he would hurry up and die. He regarded this wish for the dog's death as humane, for he could not bear, he told himself, to see anything suffer. It did not occur to him that he was really concerned about his own suffering, since the dog had adjusted himself to frailty and old age. Soaphead finally determined to put an end to the animal's misery and bought some poison with which to do it. Only the horror of having to go near him had prevented Soaphead from completing his mission. He waited for rage or blinding revulsion to spur him. Living there among his worn things, rising early every morning from dreamless sleeps, he counseled those who sought his advice. His business was dread. People came to him in dread, whispered in dread, wept and pleaded in dread, and dread was what he counseled. Singly, they found their way to his door, wrapped each in a shroud, stitched with anger, yearning, pride, vengeance, loneliness, misery, defeat, and hunger. They asked for the simplest of things, love, health, and money. Make him love me. Tell me what this dream means. Help me get rid of this woman. Make my mother give me back my clothes. Stop my left hand from shaking. Keep my baby's ghost off the stove. Break so-and-so's fix. To all of these requests, he addressed himself. His practice was to do what he was bid, not to suggest to a party that perhaps the request was unfair, mean, or hopeless. With only occasional and increasingly rare encounters with the little girls he could persuade to be entertained by him, he lived rather peaceably among his things, admitting to no regrets. He was aware, of course, that something was awry in his life, and all lives, but put the problem where it belonged, at the foot of the originator of life. He believed that since decay, vice, filth, and disorder were pervasive, they must be in the nature of things. Evil existed because God had created it. He, God, had made a sloven and unforgivable error in judgment, designing an imperfect universe. Theologians justified the presence of corruption as a means by which men strove, were tested, and triumphed. A triumph of cosmic neatness. But this neatness, the neatness of Dante, was in the orderly sectioning and segregating of all levels of evil and decay. In the world, it was not so. The most exquisite-looking ladies sat on toilets, and the most dreadful-looking had pure and holy yearnings. God had done a poor job, and Soaphead suspected that he himself could have done better. It was, in fact, a pity that the Maker had not sought his counsel. Soaphead was reflecting once again on these thoughts one late, hot afternoon when he heard a tap on his door. Opening it, he saw a little girl, quite unknown to him. She was about 12 or so, he thought, and seemed to him pitifully unattractive. When he asked her what she wanted, she did not answer, but held out to him one of his cards advertising his gifts and services. If you are overcome with trouble and conditions that are not natural, I can remove them. Overcome spells, bad luck, and evil influences. Remember, I am a true spiritualist and psychic reader, born with power, and I will help you. Satisfaction in one visit. During many years of practice, I have brought together many in marriage and reunited many who were separated. If you are unhappy, discouraged, or in distress, I can help you. Does bad luck seem to follow you? Has the one you love changed? I can tell you why. I will tell you who your enemies and friends are, and if the one you love is true or false. If you are sick, I can show you the way to health. I locate lost and stolen articles. Satisfaction guaranteed. Soaphead Church told her to come in. What can I do for you, my child? She stood there, her hands folded across her stomach, a little protruding pot of tummy. Maybe. Maybe you can do it for me. Do what for you? I can't go to school no more. Then I thought maybe you could help me. Help you how? Tell me, don't be frightened. My eyes? What about your eyes? I want them blue. Soaphead pursed his lips and let his tongue stroke a gold inlay. He thought it was at once the most fantastic and the most logical petition he had ever received. Here was an ugly little girl asking for beauty. A surge of love and understanding swept through him, but was quickly replaced by anger. Anger that he was powerless to help her. Of all the wishes people had brought him, money, love, revenge, this seemed to him the most poignant and the one most deserving of fulfillment. A little black girl who wanted to rise up out of the pit of her blackness and see the world with blue eyes. His outrage grew and felt like power. For the first time, he honestly wished he could work miracles. Never before had he really wanted the true and holy power, only the power to make others believe he had it. It seemed so sad, so frivolous, that mere mortality, not judgment, kept him from it. Or did it? With a trembling hand, he made the sign of the cross over her. His flesh crawled. In that hot, dim little room of worn things, he was chilled. I can do nothing for you, my child. I am not a magician. I work only through the Lord. He sometimes uses me to help people. All I can do is offer myself to him as the instrument through which he works. If he wants your wish granted, he will do it. Soaphead walked to the window, his back to the girl. His mind raced, stumbled, and raced again. How to frame the next sentence? How to hang on to the feeling of power? His eye fell on old Bob, sleeping on the porch. We must make, some offering, that is. Some contact with nature. Perhaps some simple creature might be the vehicle through which he will speak. Let us see. He knelt down at the window and moved his lips. After what seemed a suitable length of time, he rose and went to the icebox that stood near the other window. From it, he removed a small packet wrapped in pinkish butcher paper. From a shelf, he took a small brown bottle and sprinkled some of its contents on the substance inside the paper. He put the packet, partly opened, on the table. Take this food and give it to the creature sleeping on the porch. Make sure he eats it, and mark well how he behaves. If nothing happens, you will know that God has refused you. If the animal behaves strangely, your wish will be granted on the day following this one. The girl picked up the packet. The odor of the dark, sticky meat made her want to vomit. She put a hand on her stomach. Courage, courage, my child. These things are not granted to faint hearts. She nodded and swallowed visibly, holding down the vomit. Soaphead opened the door, and she stepped over the threshold. Goodbye, God bless, he said, and quickly shut the door.